Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This weekend marks the 79th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the event in 1938 Nazi Germany against its Jewish population that is widely considered to be the beginning of the Holocaust. There'll be a commemoration Sunday afternoon at 2, and it will feature the story of a child survivor of the Holocaust whose family was sheltered by a French Protestant commune in southern France. The village of Le Chambon-sur-Lignon sheltered up to 5,000 Jews in and around the small town during the course of the Nazi occupation of France. Pierre Sauvage's family was one of those families. In fact, he was born there. As a documentary filmmaker, Pierre Sauvage has told the story of what he's called the first responders of the Holocaust, telling the story of Le Chambon in his 1989 film, Weapons of the Spirit. He's also in the process of finishing two other films on people who intervened and sounded the alarm. Controversial figure in America, Peter Bergson, and American intellectual Varian Fry, who worked in Marseille to get prominent Jewish and anti-Nazi artists and writers out of occupied France. Those are both due out next year. Sauvage will be speaking at the Jewish Federation of Tulsa's Kristallnacht commemoration Sunday afternoon at 2 at the Federation, speaking on the first responders of the Holocaust, and there'll be a showing of his newly remastered film Weapons of the Spirit Saturday evening at 7 at the Circle Cinema. Pierre Sauvage, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
A lot of your work is focused on what Israel refers to as the righteous of the nations, the people, the non-Jews who saved Jews during the Holocaust. In fact, you owe your life to a community of non-Jews who sheltered your family. You were born in 1944, probably didn't remember those incidents at the time. When did you first hear the story of your family's survival through the residents of Le Chambon-sur-Lignon?
Well, in terms of how I came to the story, it's a little complicated because I was raised in a sort of a strange way, but maybe I can get back to that. But you're right that I've focused a lot on the righteous Gentiles of the Holocaust. But in a way, my primary interest is not really on the murderers. It's not even on the victims. It's on everybody else. It's how do people respond faced with such challenges. So then you have the righteous who responded well, and you have everybody else who responded sometimes not so well.
Everything from indifference to hostility.
Absolutely.
You've really mostly told stories of those who urged this idea of being a first responder, which is what you're going to talk about on Sunday. What is a first responder of the Holocaust?
Well, it's a trick title in a way, and because as we understand first responders, as we use the term today, and it's become a very popular term, we mean trained professionals who respond to a crisis. The paradox of the formulation is that the trained professionals at that time did not respond to that crisis. And here people get very confused because, of course, we fought World War II. And by the way, I realize that this is the weekend of Veterans Day, and it's important to pay tribute to those who fought and who did all they could, sometimes sacrificing everything, to win a war that needed to be won. But that said, the war was not fought to save the Jews, and in fact, largely failed to do so. So then who were the first responders? Well, I will claim that the first responders were, in fact, ordinary people here and there who simply rose to the challenge and felt that they couldn't stand idly by while their friend or their neighbor or a stranger was being persecuted and even, they may have suspected, murdered.
And a good number of those people were located in Le Chambon-sur-Lignon, where your family was sheltered.
That's right, and Le Chambon is truly an unusual story because it was a community. After all, most of us live in communities. Most of the rescuers of the Holocaust, by and large, were individuals. There are very few community-wide efforts, and this is the community-wide effort that was really the most dense activity of rescue to occur on that scale for that length of time anywhere in occupied Europe. And yes, I had the incredible good fortune of my parents finding their way there and being born and sheltered there. And obviously, that knowledge has shaped my view of those times, unquestionably.
When you think about how divided our country is today, or how most countries are, or even how most communities can be divided about any issue, especially an issue that involves life and death, like the invasion of a country and an invading force basically saying one part of your citizens are to be persecuted. Mm-hmm. You can imagine what it takes a special community where everybody pitches in, and it sounds like Le Chambon was that community. It was an unusual community. It was a commune, right?
Well, it was an unusual community because of its history, because of its geographic circumstances, because of its faith. I will mention, I come from a very anti-religious background, and it was, for me, very, very startling to discover the people of Le Chambon and to understand, to realize how special they were in such extraordinarily positive ways, which maybe one of the most distinctive features that I came to realize was the fact that they felt very rooted. They were rooted in their history, which was a very specific one, which I can maybe touch upon, but they were also rooted in their faith. They were Christians who really believed in living their faith and living their faith as the descendants of the Huguenots, the first Protestants in Catholic France, and who had, and this is the particularity of Le Chambon, that they had their own history of persecution. So as a result, they knew people could be persecuted, and they knew that one could resist persecution because their ancestors had done that, and they rose to the occasion.
Yeah, the Huguenots were persecuted greatly through the 16th, 17th, 18th century for being Protestant in a Catholic France.
That's right. And the other component of this is something Americans sometimes have a little difficulty taking in, is it's not only that they had been persecuted, but that they remembered it, that it mattered to them. They felt it was an integral part of who they were. They felt that they couldn't forget about that past. America was built on a different ethos. A lot of Americans are the descendants of immigrants who wanted to forget. And part of the culture of America has been to forget, to put the past behind you. Well, of course, we should put bad things behind us, but we cannot disown our past. We cannot disown not only who we are, but who we were. And that the people of Le Chambon understood.
You know, that the idea of the fresh start, that was a major component of many Holocaust survivors who came to this country. How did you learn your story?
Well, you know, I alluded to the fact that my own personal history is a little complicated because my parents were among the Jews of Europe who came. My parents went to New York when I was four in 1948, and they chose to put the past behind them to the extent of not even telling me that they were Jewish and that I was Jewish. And I ended up not learning all that till I was 18. And that, too, has shaped my view of things, because I'm distinctly aware, because I experienced it personally, of the power of taboos. And hence I've had a tendency, and I will be underscoring that in my remarks on Sunday, because I'll be showing clips of other films that deal in particular with how America responded to the crisis, which is a subject of fascination to me, and how much difficulty we have accepting our share of responsibility for what happened. And we live under taboos. And I have to mention, I would be remiss if I did not mention, I'm distinctly aware of the fact that I am going to be speaking in Tulsa, in the home of the terrible 1921 riot. And one of the things that strikes me most about that story is my understanding is that for many decades afterwards, Tulsa had difficulty letting in that story. I know that's changed, but our capacity to avoid facing unpleasant aspects of our past is huge, and I believe it's unhealthy.
Yeah, so our community still has trouble.
Well, all communities have trouble.
Sure.
But I'm sure headway has been made.
Yes.
People told me that sometimes they were 40 before they even learned that there had been such a riot.
Right. Well, how did you react when you found out you were Jewish at age 18, and how did you begin trying to understand your own story?
Well, the first thing is that people think sometimes that when a taboo is lifted, that it's sort of lifted completely and fast, and that really isn't true. Even though I was told I was Jewish, for years I didn't sort of let it in. It didn't really, I was told I was Jewish, but that it didn't matter. And for many years, I accepted the fact that it didn't matter. I think three things really influenced me. One was I married a nice Jewish girl, and these things mattered to her, and she worked on me hard for years. Then we were going to have our first child, and I had been raised as a nothing. I hadn't been raised as a Christian. I had been raised, you know, in an anti-religious atmosphere, and I was raised as a nothing. Well, I didn't want my son to be a nothing. I wanted him to have a sense of identity. And then I went back to Le Chambon, and I realized how much strength these people derived from knowing who they were. So if they were deriving strength from knowing who they were, then I had might also derive some strength from knowing more about who I was. And, you know, who I am, who we all are, it's not just who we are at the present moment. We are embedded within us is history. Embedded within us is what our parents and grandparents and great-parents lived through. That is passed on, whether we identify it or not. And we can derive strength from identifying, and that's what I'm still working on.
Did you know that you had been protected when you went back to Le Chambon? Did you know that story at that point?
Well, when I went back to Le Chambon, I did know, but when I was growing up, I didn't. So when I grew up, I knew I had been born in this mountain village in south central France, which I thought was peculiar. But I didn't know how unusual the story of this area was, and so no. When I went back, I didn't know the story, but I still had much to learn because I had to overcome all the prejudices that I had against religious people.
Once you determine the scale of this story, where you have thousands of Jews sheltered by a few thousand Christians in southern France, when did you decide to tell that story?
Well, I decided to tell it pretty quickly. I was really lucky in that respect because I mentioned this to a friend who had connections with French television. I had been working in public television in Los Angeles, so I had, you know, some documentary experience, but I'd never done anything quite this ambition. And it sort of came together very quickly. I hasten to clarify that there were thousands of Jews saved. The best estimate, the one I use in the film, is that some 5,000 Jews were sheltered throughout the area, not just in the village, but the village is part of a plateau. And people were sheltered here and there throughout that plateau, which was known at the time as the Protestant Plateau. But this was not at one time.
Right.
The village ended up becoming the village in the area, becoming a place from which people would arrive and leave, and organizations used the place to shelter people for a while and then brought them elsewhere. But I shot the film quickly. The biggest challenge to me was editing the film, because as I was looking at the footage, I realized I didn't have a clue what the footage meant. I didn't understand these people. I didn't know how to portray them. It was an extremely difficult editing process. And it took me, you know, a long time, as an example, to realize that a person's shrug was more important sometimes than a speech.
Hmm.
What we put in words is often nonsense. What we express with our bodies is often quite candid. And these people really felt, this is one of the things that strikes most viewers, and understandably so, it struck me as well, that these people truly felt that what they did was no big deal. Maybe they wouldn't have, well, I'm not going to say they wouldn't have done it if they felt it was a big deal. I think they would have done it anyway. But they just... they were just doing what came naturally to them. And, you know, that that's not the type of thing that one attributes importance to. I've said sometimes, show me a boastful rescuer, and I'll show you a liar. It doesn't go with the territory.
Of course, they did that at enormous personal risk. There were members of the community that were shipped off to concentration camps and later murdered.
Well, that's right, and they didn't know the extent. I mean, the area ended up being relatively spared for all sorts of reasons, but they certainly, there was a Gestapo raid there in which some people were indeed shipped out, and they certainly didn't know, you know, they knew there was risk, but to them, the greater risk would have been to make themselves unrecognizable in their own minds, You know, they had to remain faithful to who they were.
My guest today is documentary filmmaker Pierre Sauvage. He is the filmmaker behind the film Weapons of the Spirit, which tells the story of Le Chambon-sur-Lignon, a little community in southern France that sheltered Jews during the Holocaust, a Protestant Huguenot commune located in the Auvergne. He is himself a survivor of that community, a Holocaust child survivor. He'll be speaking at the Jewish Federation of Tulsa's Kristallnacht commemoration coming up Sunday at 2, speaking on first responders of the Holocaust. There'll also be a showing of Weapons of the Spirit Saturday evening at 7 at the Circle Cinema, and he'll be doing some talk back after the showing of the film. He's also the creator of another film, which has, I guess, been worked on for a long time, and I think it's coming out this year, and still working on yet another film. And I assume these are other first responders, too. You have a new film coming out, hopefully soon, Not Idly By, Peter Bergson, America and the Holocaust. And this is a film that I think you've had ready to go. It's just about getting it out to the public for some time. And it's a story that really is not really well known about how people responded to the Holocaust here in the United States.
Well, that's right. It's a very challenging, that particular film is a very challenging film, particularly to Jews, because its primary focus is how the American Jewish community responded to the crisis. And the bottom line is the American Jewish community did not respond very well for all sorts of reasons that the film partly goes into, and it's built around the testimony of one person who lived through that time. We Jews, just like everybody else, have difficulty recognizing sometimes the, you know, difficult aspects of our own history. So nobody should be smug about any of this. Life is full of challenges, and the best we can do is to simply try to learn from the past.
You know, when we've looked at a lot of the refugee situation today, I think it would be very wise for everybody to learn about somebody like Breckinridge Long, who was the State Department official that basically shut down immigration from Europe during the early part of the war, really all the way up until 44 when he was forced out, to understand, you know, what's happening today. There are mirror incidents from the past.
Well, that's right. And another documentary that I've been working on for a long time is on an American rescue mission in France during that time, where some 2,000 people were helped, many of them prominent luminaries, of cultural luminaries of Europe. And this was led by a New York intellectual named Varian Fry. And very few people indeed, have ever heard the name Varian Fry. And yet he was a true American hero. But the part of the point of that story is that everything he was doing was flying in the face of what American policy was at the time. It wasn't just, you're absolutely right about Breckinridge Long, but that filtered over, you know, the biggest enemies of the Fry mission in France were the people at the American consulate in Marseille, where he was doing his work, who never looked upon him as anything other than a troublemaker. So yes, there is a lot to be learned from how, you know, America responded to that refugee crisis. And obviously, we have to figure out how we are going to respond to refugee crises as they occur, and they're occurring more and more hugely these days.
Tell us a little bit more about Varian Fry.
A group of New Yorkers realized that with the fall of France, there were a lot of people in France who were the Nazis initially, in the Nazi occupation of France, expected to go after those who had taken refuge in France. Who were not so much even Jewish, but prominent anti-Nazis who had left Germany or left Austria after it was taken over and found themselves in France. So a group of New Yorkers realized that these people were really vulnerable, and they formed a group to help get them out. And Varian Fry, a New York intellectual, as I mentioned, I like that dimension of the stories because we seldom hear of intellectuals really getting their hands dirty. And he certainly did. He volunteered to go to France and go to Marseille in the unoccupied southern zone, initially unoccupied southern zone, to get these people out. It's truly an amazing story.
Was he successful in getting many of them out? Did they come to the United States or did they go elsewhere?
2,000 people out, and many of them are very famous, like Chagall and Max Ernst and Jack Lipschitz and Hannah Arendt, and people whom anybody who's interested in European culture would recognize the names. And I'll mention parenthetically, because it's, I guess, an amusing part of the story, is that my parents were in Marseille when Varian Fry was there, and they had left Paris to go south, which was a lot of what a lot of Jews of Paris did, and they sought help from the Fry mission, and they did not receive it. And subsequently, they found their way to Le Chambon. So in a way, but with these two films, I'm covering two aspects of my own life.
Interesting. And so I guess Varian Fry was helping, you know, when you think of the Nazis taking over, what did they do? They burned books, they burned paintings, they burned art that they considered degenerate. They were really helping those writers and artists and people of the cultural life that the Nazis were out to get, I guess.
Absolutely right. The other part of the Varian Fry story that I like, and there are many, is that Varian was himself a lover of the arts. And in focusing particularly on those people in Europe, he was helping people he loved. And, you know, in the Jewish tradition, your first obligation is to the people you love, is to your family. Your obligation should extend beyond that. But that's where you start. And Varian Fry had his hands full. Varian Fry and the people who joined with him, some of whom became my friends subsequently, these people really did all they could to help not just these artists, but also others as well.
But, you know, you take it a step further, you look at the villagers of Le Chambon, they're taking in the stranger and yep. doing the same thing. That's got to be even a greater piece of work there.
Well, I guess one of them might respond to you that these strangers weren't entirely strangers, because for the Chambonnais, for the Christians of Le Chambon, the Jews were the people of the book, and these were Christians who lived daily with what they called the Old Testament, not just the New Testament, and they felt a genuine affinity. You know, yes, there are strangers in the world, and we have to decide how much we can do for them, how much we want to do for them, but I think part of the process is being able to recognize that they are less strangers than we think, that there is a common human bond, and once one starts experiencing that, it's very difficult to turn away.
You mentioned your family really never talked about this episode in their life. Were you ever able to talk to members of your family about what happened at Le Chambon?
Well, subsequently, yes. Subsequent to my childhood, I mean, to some extent. But this was not my parents' favorite subject, even though they thought very well of Le Chambon, which to me was among the most telling validations that the story was true, because given their anti-religious bias, they would have had every reason not to think well of these people, and yet they did think well of these people. But they didn't really like talking about it that much, and I think this is true generally of Jews who were sheltered during the Holocaust. For many years, the Jews really didn't talk much about the rescuers. And it seems strange, you know, here were people who had often risked their lives to save them, and the Jews did not appear to be remembering. And what one has to understand is, A, they had gone through very traumatic times, and in some ways it's understandable that they would want to move on. And part of the trauma was also their sense of dependency, you know, that they had been very dependent during that time, and that's a very unpleasant sensation. So when I started out to make Weapons of the Spirit, this was not a popular subject. I was very helped by the survivor author, Nobel Prize laureate, Elie Wiesel, who always said to me, no, this is important. And he sort of, to those survivors in particular who felt that this would dwarf their experience, the concern was that people would use the rescuers as alibis, that the world would say, see, the world wasn't that bad. There were these survivors. What are you complaining about? My sense is that the rescuers are something quite different. The rescuers are acts of accusation. The rescuers stress by their very existence what it was possible to do, what it was possible to know, what it was possible to do. And hence, they make everybody else accountable. And that's why I also think the rescuers, in some respects, scare us. We always think the villains scare us, but I think the rescuers scare us even more because the rescuers hold us accountable.
Pierre Sauvage, thank you very much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Documentary filmmaker Pierre Sauvage speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be the guest speaker at the Jewish Federation of Tulsa's Kristallnacht commemoration Sunday afternoon at 2 at the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. The Circle Cinema will also offer a showing of his documentary film, Weapons of the Spirit. That will be showing Saturday evening at 7. For details on these events, visit jewishtulsa.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
It was 7:21 p.m. on November 8th, 2016, exactly about a year ago. I was leaving the house to do a political podcast with Ziva Branstetter, then executive editor of The Frontier. The TV was on, and as I opened the front door, I looked back and saw that in Florida, with 92% of the vote recorded, Donald Trump was up by 2%. The state wasn't being called because after 2000, the state is never called. North Carolina was gone. Virginia was too close to call. You could tell. Nobody said it, but it's over. Not just Florida, all of it. Donald J. Trump would be president of the United States. There was supposed to be history that night. Instead, there was cheap wine. The next day, talking with then-editor of Esquire Mark Warren, I mentioned how we accept it's the will of the people. Other pablum, he was furious. The resistance, he said, all caps, you could hear it, begins today. It was November 9th, and so it did. And here we are at the end of year one. It was a year and a resistance, as Dahlia Lithwick of Slate Magazine told me, that both saved her life and was going to kill her. I felt that. When you lose sleep over the actions of the incoming agriculture secretary, you know your relationship with the only country you've ever known has changed. In 2017, one wakes up every day shocked but not necessarily surprised. Linda Charnes, a professor at the University of Indiana, said, "We've tripled the five stages of grief to 15. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, overeating, day drinking, bargaining with pets, sheer disbelief, pathetic hope, hedge despair, day sleeping, marching, signing petitions, headbanging, and mullah worship. However, we did bump one category from the five," she said, "acceptance. The offenses of the past year, both virtual and real and grammatical, by this president were incalculable. The EPA and the education departments, the using of the Justice Department as his own personal legal firm, the saber-rattling with North Korea, the tap-dancing with Russia. With Trump, there was always a new bottom. His successes, such as they were mostly celebrated not for their value, but for their ability to annoy liberals. Welcome to bifurcated America. A little more than half the country, but a clear majority, have for the last 12 months been alternately speechless, verbose, angry, and exhausted. It's been excruciating. The rest, the hardcore Trump supporters, find memes. Trump is the chauffeur, Hillary Clinton in the back seat. The caption, Donald Trump is driving Dems crazy. Hilarious. It's the new currency, though. Trumpism is Schadenfreude. So what happened to us, or have we always been this? A country en masse should have rejected a president who insists on calling a United States Senator Pocahontas and the leader of North Korea Rocket Man. A country en masse should be furious its president has been tougher on Alec Baldwin than Vladimir Putin. A country en masse should see that but for a hairstyle, our president is Harvey Weinstein. We were told not to generalize, not to judge, to find common ground. Fine. Now find me a neo-Nazi who's concerned about climate change. Many of us took this personally, this first year very personally. Saturday Night Live is not the enemy. Cabinet secretaries shouldn't distrust government. Sure, those screaming most and loudest were liberals and progressives, but we were also Americans, and that's the point. Since November 8th, 2016, we don't recognize the place, and Donald Trump doesn't recognize us. It's now 2017. A year later. And that hasn't changed.
Barry Friedman is a writer, essayist, a columnist for the Tulsa Voice, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.